What was the situation like when you first arrived at Wayne State? Did they have much of a research program going at that time, or was it just building?
Well, it was certainly an organic. It was essentially Herb Brown and his group. So there really wasn't much there. And this was very primitive facilities, and not much of it. At MIT, of course, we had excellent facilities, so it was quite an improvement over Illinois in those days. So when I went to Wayne, I was back probably worse than Illinois, and of course I did then very quickly inherit Herb Brown's labs, he had gone in there and really installed those labs himself, and did essentially all the plumbing and things like that himself. He really worked at it. That was, we had very little space for anything, and so it was difficult until we got the new building, and we got that just about the time I left. So the first years we had labs right in the rest of the building with all these non-chemists all around us, and obviously they didn't appreciate all these odors and things. So what it was an old high school building. So they took over the old central, it was an abandoned old central high school down in the slum areas of Detroit. And they had built it up, of course, after the war. And that they were just coming into their own. And it was a municipal university, and so their facilities were about as primitive as you could get, in the thing. But the enthusiasm was very high. Everybody had very high hopes for the university and had big plans for it. And certainly, chemistry was moving ahead quite fast.
What kind of person was Neil Gordon, the department chairman?
Well, of course, he was just very unusual. Of course, it's a coincidence that he was department chairman here at Maryland.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and for a number of years, and he actually started the Journal of Chemical Education here, and then moved on to Johns Hopkins. And while he was at Johns Hopkins, he started the Gibson Island Conference, which is in the Chesapeake Bay, and the forerunner of the Gordon Research Conferences. And then while he was there, he instituted this Johns Hopkins Fellowship Plan, which was very unusual in that he, in practically every state in the Union, he organized a committee that raised money to send a graduate student to Hopkins with all their money paid. And that was so successful that the president of the university wanted them to do that in other fields, and he wouldn't do it, and the president got mad at him, and so he left Johns Hopkins and went out to Central College in Missouri. And while he was also here, he became intrigued with Hooker, and had a chance to pick up Hooker's library. So Hooker was one of these industrial chemists that did all this research on quinones and all this, that and had amassed his own private library, and did all this work on his own on the side. And then after he retired, he kept on doing that, but never published anything until Fieser ran into him, and Fieser was working on quinones, and he found out that Hooker had done much of the same stuff that he had, only more so. So that Fieser wrote up part of Hooker's stuff, but when Gordon found out about this library, and he had all these old rare editions, you know, the Proceedings of the Royal Society back to Volume 1 and stuff like that, and he was always trying to raise money to build it, and so he took it out with him and to Central College of Missouri, and they didn't have any facilities to keep it up. So we only had this opportunity to go to Wayne. He says, "I'll come if you promise to take care of my library." And so a lot of the industry around there pledged some money to for the department and to maintain the library. And one of the guys that sort of promised him money was Kresge at that time, to entice him to come. So he came and moved his library and everything, and had the Hooker Library there. And then I think every day he would call up Kresge and says, "Where's that money you promised me?" And so finally, Kresge gave him $100,000 in those days, and so they changed the name to the Kresge Hooker Library, and it's a marvelous library. And they were able to raise enough extra money to build a separate building, and it's as that. So he was a delightful old man at that time when I knew him.
Was he chair the 4 years you were there?
He committed suicide. I think the third year I was there, and then a guy by the name of Russell Bright took over as chairman, and we were recruiting quite a few people. We recruited George Coleman, who had been at Iowa, and then ended up as editor of the Journal of Organic Chemistry, as to be director of the Hooker Library. And then he ended up right after I left as department chairman, because he was a very sound guy. And then I recruited Cal Stevens to come in and help me the year after Herb left, and Cal was still there, and there were quite a few of the other people that came in. Jurassi took my place.
Jurassi, yeah.
Took my place after I left.
I see.
Right.
Okay.
And he didn't stay so long, and so Wayne has been sort of famous for the guys that have been there and left. So you can name quite a few people. Cava was there for a while, and Allinger was there, and so there was quite an influx of people in and out. So it was a good stepping stone for a lot of people.
That's quite a list. You had two things I wanted to look at when you got to Wayne. First, the courses you were teaching. You said you gave 18
lectures. Yeah, I taught the all the graduate courses in organic, and some of the undergraduate courses.
But how long did that situation last?
Well, it only lasted that 1 year, but it was kind of funny. They had this scheme that Herb Brown had put in, that he says, well, let's assume that the normal teaching load is 18 hours. Then for every paper you publish, you can subtract 2 hours from the primary teaching load. So if you turn out 9 papers a year, you don't have to teach. Well, that sounded good to everybody. And so, of course, Herb worked it out, so it was fine. He didn't have to teach anything. So some of the people had to teach you quite a bit. So when I was teaching this 18 hours, everybody thought that was fine. Well, I haven't published any papers yet.
And you said you also, well, did you have any students that first year? Brown left the year after that.
No, well, he left the first year that I was there.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you really must have had some made-to-order students.
Yeah, that's right. So I got all the students that he would have gotten. So I got picked up 10. At the end of the first year, I had 10 students working for me.
And that first year, well, I guess by 48, you had made the first all-cis diene polymer with Golden.
Right.
I want to ask you something about Golden too, but how did you select those target molecules? That is, how did you determine what you were going to do in your research when you first started?
Well, I just knew that I wanted to pick out some problems that were significant and yet fairly easy to solve, and so I just tried to find some molecules that would be of extreme interest that I thought that I could solve. And so the dimethylene cyclohexane was one that I thought was a very interesting diene that was going to give us an all-cis polymer. And it wasn't too complicated, so we certainly went after that right away, and that we were able to make it and polymerize it and get some very interesting results.
What kind of a student was Harold Golden?
Well, of course, he was an older student. He was older than I was.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and again, he had worked at U.S. Rubber there in Detroit for quite a few years during the war, and so he had maybe 10 years of industrial experience before he decided to come back. More mature, and there's a lot of the students that I had at that time, had been in the war and came back, and quite a few of them were older than I was, and so they were ready to go to work, and not much fooling around. And they were married, and some of them had kids and stuff like this, and they were very, very, very serious, hardworking students. And they were easy to motivate.
After that first paper on the polymer synthesis, much of your subsequent work in those next few years was in developing the cyclic dienes, which would then be monomers. There didn't seem to be much in terms of actual polymerization for reactions. Were you doing both?
Well, of course, a lot of the dienes we did polymerize. Some of them were. It's kind of funny. You'll see some compound that you worked on, for instance, the thiophene dioxide that I did with Earl Cummins back there. Uh, that was one of these compounds again that people had wondered about, wondered if it was going to be aromatic or not, and nobody had ever made it, and so we made it and showed that it was highly reactive, and now a whole bunch of papers are coming out on it. We just had a seminar where one of the guys has a new Biden synthesis that uses the thiophene dioxide as an intermediate, and so it's kind of strange that you'll see these things recycling.
Again, what I wanted to ask is how you selected the nature of these target molecules.
Well, again, thiophene dioxide was one just in the literature that was a diene, and it was had both theoretical and practical interest, and I thought that from the chemistry that we had done at for psychoactive tetraene, I could do the same kind of chemistry and come out with the thing, and it turned out it was a more sensitive molecule than psychoactive tetraene. But we used the same kind of chemistry, and it was important intermediate, both in the theoretical and synthetic aspect, and the way it went. So. Then we developed a bunch of synthetic techniques, and so for some of our monomers we had to study some ester pyrolysis, and then you'll notice an overlap there of synthesizing unusual dienes to studying ester pyrolysis, and so we continued that for quite some time then.
Did you develop any consulting relationships when you were at Wayne?
Just at the tail end of when I was at Wayne, I had a consultantship with the Union Carbide. That they were looking for young guys that were knew something about polymers, and there weren't a large number around that could go around to all the companies. So, Carbide thought I was a good bet, so they offered me this consulting ship. So I stayed with them for maybe 6-7 years.
Kind of support was there for your students? Did you have to start getting your own support for your students?
Oh yeah. Some of my first support was through the Research Corporation, and they have the starter grant where you're just starting out, and so I got one of those, and. Then the Office of Naval Research had a program that was pre-National Science Foundation. There wasn't any National Science Foundation at that time. So they were interested in some polymer research and basic research. So I got a grant of $20,000. And that was enough to support 10 students. So Wayne had a pretty good system. They had no money for salaries, but we did have a pretty good system where you could check out things out of the stockroom, and as long as you weren't outrageous, the department paid for it. So we had to buy the big pieces of equipment, but. Things like glassware and chemicals and everything, we didn't have to charge to anything. The department would would pay for that. Not the way it is anymore anywhere, I don't think. And so this $20,000, you know, paid for the overhead and the salary and the equipment and everything else on this basis for 10 graduate students. So that was the bulk of my money at that time. And of course, when I moved to Maryland here, I transferred that contract with me. And so it was a real lifesaver in that respect. Now $20,000, I really can't, I can support one student, a graduate student, on $20,000.
Did the university have any teaching positions for graduate students?
Oh yeah, sure. Just like any other, that we have teaching assistants that would that would teach and have the remission of the fees and stuff like that. Yeah.
What was your teaching of the second year after you?
Well,
the Brown rule still in existence?
No, that was modified, but at least it dropped quite a bit. So as things went on, I think the next year it dropped down to 12 or something like that. The teaching loads were high at Wayne.
All the 12 is high.
Yeah, well, on today's standards, that would be excessive. But on the standards that they had there, that wasn't so bad.
Was anyone else doing any polymer work?
Well, there was Wilfred Heller, who was a physical chemist, and he was interested in both colloid and polymers.
What about testing some of the things that you made? Did you still send them out for testing?
Well, more or less, we got somebody else to do testing. Testing is something that takes also specialized equipment and things like that. So even today, I don't really do much testing. We get a student to go over and use an Instron or something like that, but much more sophisticated than that. You have to get somebody that knows what the results mean as well.
Why did you decide to leave Wayne?
Well, I was offered a full professorship here, a research professorship, and so there were quite a few things. Of course, as a research professor, I wasn't going to teach very much, so that was attractive. And then, of course, the area was much more attractive than Wayne. Wayne was in this slum area, and it wasn't really a decent place to live within an hour's drive from there. The idea of being able to live within walking distance of a campus appealed to me as a small town boy. And, this, of course, is a very active research area, and so Wayne, made the counteroffer to keep me. They offered me a full professorship if I'd stay, and offered me quite an increase in salary. And so actually, I took a cut in salary over what I could have gotten if I'd stayed at Wayne. But the attractiveness of quite a few things out here made me jump at the chance. So Maryland wasn't not in the top echelon of universities, but it was at least an improvement over Wayne at that time.
Were there other possibilities? Had you ever thought about going into industry at any time?
Not really. I never considered that. Most academic people don't. My only industrial experience, I spent a summer at Nallencrot in St. Louis in the summer of 42, during my junior and senior year. And that was a delightful experience. I worked for August Hohmeyer for quite a bit of the summer, and he gave me some advanced synthesis to run through, and he was just a delightful guy to work for, and so I still correspond with him and see him once in a while. And and then my consulting experience has kept me in contact with industry. So because of that contact, some of my work is more practical than maybe some of my other colleagues, because I do keep up with industrial problems and outlook and things like that. So when I teach my courses and things, I include a lot of current industrial practice, things of that type.
Let me ask at this point, and since we're talking about that, do you think that in a chemistry curriculum today, the students do not get sufficient exposure to industrial? Industrial chemistry.
Yeah, that's right. They don't. Most of them are going to end up in industry, and most of the professors don't know any industrial chemistry, so they really can't teach them. And the rest of them are trying to, even their graduate students are trying to produce clones of themselves, and so they train their students to be college professors rather than to be industrial chemists. And so it's hard for them to look for a job because they are sort of looking for the same kind of chemistry that they did in graduate work, because that's what they feel comfortable with, and they know they can do a good job in that, but they don't know whether they can do a good job in some other field. So they're then have a hard time even talking to the industrial people about what they would have to do. And
what about your own students? How have they been distributed?
Most of them again go into industry. Now I have a number of students that are in academic work, but the bulk of them are certainly in industry. Because that's where the bulk of the chemists go anyway, right?